Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Stephen Walt, who's the Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and John Mearsheimer, who's the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. Together, they are the co-authors of the New York Times bestseller, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. We'll also be joined by General Wesley Clark, who's a retired four-star general of the United States Army. He was a former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. He ran for President of the United States. And he has a new book which casts a new light on the Bush administration's secret strategies for regime change in Iran and elsewhere, seven countries in all. So that should be an interesting insight into what is happening. And, of course, his new book, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. I believe I have Stephen Walt on, do I?
You do.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me. So how are you doing in terms of the reaction to the book? Was pretty, there was a blizzard of early reaction to your original article that was then originally commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly. They took a pass on it. It was printed in the London Review of Books. It got quite both a positive and a negative reaction, and then the book has exponentially gotten a greater reaction. Let's begin with that idea of the, you know, we've just had Ann Coulter's extraordinary remarks made this couple of days ago on CNBC, which weren't her usual method, which is to be provocative and just sell her books and in a cynical and irresponsible way. She actually believes the insanity that she's putting forth. The charge that you've gotten from people like Abe Foxman of the Defamation League is that even though you may not be anti-Semitic and the book itself may not be anti-Semitic, you're aiding and abetting anti-Semites because they are, I take it, very impressionable people.
I think that's a not surprising line of criticism towards us. But if you think about it for a minute, the idea that any criticism of Israel or any criticism of pro-Israel groups in the United States cannot be undertaken because it would somehow fuel anti-Semitism, if you take that sincerely, then you are effectively saying it is absolutely impossible to raise any doubts about U.S. policy in the Middle East, to raise any doubts about Israeli policy in the Middle East, or to question the wisdom of the policies that groups like AIPAC or others are advocating. And one of our core arguments in the book is that, in fact, the failure to discuss these matters openly has both been harmful to the United States, but also consistently harmful to Israel as well. All countries make mistakes from time to time, and if the United States wants to be a good ally, a good friend to Israel, it ought to be able to have an open debate about what its own policies are and what Israeli policies are, so that we can give them good advice. And when something, like the Settlements Project gets underway, Americans can weigh in and say this is not a good idea. When something like the Lebanon War of last summer occurs and Israel's strategy for dealing with Hezbollah turns out to be misguided, we ought to be able to point that out to them quickly. So this argument that somehow by trying to encourage a more open public debate about U.S. policy in the Middle East, we're somehow aiding anti-Semitism, I think, first of all, it's just wrong, and anybody who reads our book will see that we are staunchly opposed to anyone who is anti-Semitic. But secondly, it encourages a set of policies that are not good for anybody, not good for the United States, and not good for Israel either.
And John Mearsheimer, I just recently had the head of the woman who founded Peace Now in Israel, big grassroots movement, that and she was there standing next to Rabin when he was assassinated. And of course, that was the sort of beginning of the end in many ways, certainly of the Oslo Accords. I asked her about the whether or not there was a debate in Israel prior to getting into Iraq, and and also a debate now in Israel about starting a war with Iran. And she said, no, there really wasn't any kind of a debate in Israel about going into Iraq. It was always an American war and an American initiative. And then on the case of getting into Iran, she said, well, there's, you know, if the Bush administration is crazy enough to start a war with Iran, we'll be the ones that get hit. So that was her version of Israeli politics. What's your reading and from your book about how much it was the neoconservatives and their connections to the Israeli right that got us into that war?
Well, with regard to Israel itself, there was no debate, no serious debate about going to war against Iraq inside Israel, because there was no opposition of any significance. The fact is that the Israeli people strongly supported an American invasion of Iraq, and their leaders pushed the United States very hard to go to war against Iraq. So the argument that the Israelis didn't really care one way or the other regarding what the United States did in Iraq is not true, and it fails the common sense test. The Israelis care greatly about what happens in the region, especially to adversaries like Iraq. With regard to Iran, there's no question that the Israeli government is pushing the United States very hard to countenance using military force against Iran. And it's very clear from the poll data that that position enjoys widespread support inside of Israel.
Even though, as Gali Gilad said, the feeling is that if the United States attacks Iran, it will be Israel that's retaliated against.
That may be true, but the fact of the matter is the United States will be retaliated against as well. This is one of the main reasons that the American military is so deeply opposed to attacking Iran. There's some talk in the news media of this these days, not a whole heck of a lot, but the American military is not enthusiastic at all. In fact, there's lots of evidence that the American military leadership is opposed to a war against Iran because they understand that the Iranians will attack American troops in Afghanistan, American troops in Iraq, and in other places around the world. So it's not going to be just the Israelis that get hit, but it's clear, regardless of all that, that the Israeli government and the Israeli people would like us to strike Iran if we can't shut down Iran's nuclear program through diplomatic channels.
And Stephen Walt, just carrying through with this, since it's in very much in the press, the New York Times has been running a series of articles about September 9th attack, Israeli air attack inside Syria, which was originally said to be against a North Korean-built facility or aided facility. Then the New York Times recently said that, no, it looks as though that's just John Bolton injecting North Korea into the mix in order to scuttle the six-party power agreement, which the North Koreans are about to have, in fact, signed and are about to negotiate further on. And, of course, you recall that we got the North Koreans back to the table by simply paying a $25 million bribe, which is pretty cheap. Now, the New York Times is suggesting that maybe there was some nuclear component there. But the long and short of it is, I understand that this is, again, a case where intelligence was stovepiped directly from Israel into the vice presidency. And what do you know, or what can you speculate about what this is about?
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, none of us know much more than what's been reported in a number of newspapers, and that information is quite incomplete and should be taken, I think, with many grains of salt at this point. I mean, the Times report today suggests that both U.S. and Israeli intelligence ultimately concluded that the Syrians were beginning some sort of nuclear reactor construction. It was in the very early stages. It wasn't close to becoming operational or having nuclear material in it. And the Times also reported that the Israelis you know, decided to go after it, even though the Americans weren't entirely sure that it was time to do that or necessary to do that. I would just note, by the way, that this is a case where a country that is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty was building a reactor, which it's entitled to do under that treaty if it then puts it under International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards. And, of course, it's long before it would have needed to do that, and it got attacked by a country that hasn't signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty and has a sizable nuclear arsenal of its own. I think we still are not entirely sure what the Syrians were doing and whether it was appropriate or a real threat or whether the North Koreans were actively involved. It is, of course, I think, not surprising that the Israelis did this, given how seriously they take their nuclear environment. And as the New York Times reported today, their desire to try and sort of restore what they see as eroding deterrence. I've just had one other point. You know, given the record of intelligence failures in the run-up to Iraq war, I think that's a reason also just to be skeptical of almost any reports we get about what countries in that part of the world are up to.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Stephen Walton, John Mearsheimer, the co-authors of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. What explains this kind of, in the land of the free, in the home of the brave, why are we so afraid of opinions?
Well, I think, Ian, there are two reasons why the lobby goes...
And this is John Mearsheimer, sir.
Yes, this is John Mearsheimer. The lobby goes to great lengths to shut down criticism of Israeli policy and to shut down criticism of the U.S.-Israeli relationship for two closely related reasons. The first is that the case for the present relationship is simply not very strong. If Americans were able to listen to people like Steve and I talk about the strategic rationale and the moral rationale for America's unconditional support for Israel, it would quickly become clear to most Americans that the present relationship just doesn't make good sense, either on strategic grounds or moral grounds. This is not to say for one second that the United States should not support the survival of Israel. The United States should, but that's not the issue here. The question is, should we give them such remarkable levels of economic and military and diplomatic aid and give it to them unconditionally? And our point is that there's no good strategic and moral rationale for the present policy, and the lobby doesn't want people to know that. So that's the first reason. Second reason that the lobby works so hard is that there is actually not that much support inside of the United States for the present relationship. For example, the Anti-Defamation League has done a study which shows that more than 75% of Americans believe that the United States should treat the Israelis and the Palestinians in an even-handed way. In other words, we shouldn't privilege the Israelis over the Palestinians. One could point to all sorts of other data that shows that while American support for the survival of Israel is strong, American support for the present relationship is quite soft. So if you had an open debate about Israeli policy and about the American relationship with Israel, it would probably be the case that many Americans would clamor for change. And of course, the lobby doesn't want that because they want to maintain the special relationship.
Gentlemen, I would make the argument that the real issue here is that having an extraordinarily powerful lobby in Washington, like the NRA and like AIPAC, effectively means that you end up talking to yourself, that if you have that kind of influence over the Congress, they don't get off the dime, nobody gets off the dime, none of the hard decisions are made, the can's always kicked down the road, and that today we're reaping the whirlwind of this as Condoleezza Rice tries to put together a peace talk, which the Saudis have been pushing, all the Arabs are going to come aboard, it starts next month. Already it's very difficult with these two weak governments, Olmert on one side and Abu Mazen, who really doesn't represent the Palestinians, on the other. And she's not really, today she said some very wishy-washy things about, well, I can only do what they want to do. I mean, the point of the matter is that this situation needs adult supervision, and the United States needs to be the honest broker. And if you're paralyzed by the Congress, who are essentially creating a feedback loop, where everybody, sort of recycles the Israeli talking points, you get nowhere.
I think that's quite astute. When you have any sort of very powerful set of interest group, it does shape not just what policymakers do, but also just what they're even willing to consider, what they regard as politically feasible. And so, in a sense, some policy options get taken off the table before they're even considered because they're seen as just too hard to achieve. But I think there may also be an element to which of self-fulfilling prophecy here. Where, in fact, politicians are intimidated in ways they maybe shouldn't be, and that, in fact, I believe an American president who decided they wanted to take a more independent course and have a more even-handed policy and explain that to the American people, I think could actually win a lot of support. That, in a sense, you know, groups like AIPAC have some of their power derives from people thinking that they are all-powerful. And I just remind listeners that there are at least two American presidents who did try to follow a somewhat more even-handed policy, and that was Jimmy Carter and the first President Bush. And former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami points out in his own book on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, those two presidents, the two presidents who were willing to chart a more independent course from the lobby and put some pressure on Israel, were also the two presidents who made the most progress towards Middle East peace, first by, in Carter's case, by brokering the Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement, and in Bush's case, by getting the Madrid conference underway, which led to the Oslo Accords. So in a sense, you know, our point would be, look, an American president who decided to follow an even-handed policy not only could win, I think, public support for doing that, but could also actually create a genuine possibility of a final settlement of this long and tragic conflict.
The way I understand it is, and this is what I've understood from your book, is that there is a distortion here. Just as right-wing politics in this country under George W. Bush have arguably been ruinous, and he came in as a uniter, not a divider, and then has prosecuted an extremely narrow policies that favor the extreme right wing in this country and the evangelical community are equally true of the Israeli right. It only survives because of coalitions with religious groups, as well as, of course, these coalitions can switch sides, as we know. But the long and the short of it is that my understanding is that when you talk about the lobby, this lobby does not represent, AIPAC does not represent the majority views of American Jewry, nor do they represent the majority views of the Israelis. Because one of the things that keeps coming back all the time, and it came up in the discussion I had recently with the founder of Peace Now, Galia Galand, was that consistently polls indicate that 70% of the United States, people in the United States, want an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. 70% of the Israeli people want an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, and 70% of the Palestinian people want an Israeli peace deal. So who are this 30% who have managed to stall, scuttle this process?
Well, what we think of as the lobby is a coalition of different organizations and groups, and they don't agree on every issue. And it includes, of course, both American Jews and non-Jews as well, Christian evangelicals and others. What we describe in the book is how, over time, the more hardline elements, the groups that tend to be more expansionist, more aligned with either the settler movement in Israel or the Likud party in Israel, have become more powerful and more influential, have more resources. And some of the other groups within the pro-Israel community who are more moderate have just not had as loud a voice. So your description is basically accurate. And I would argue that, as you said, they're not representative of broad American opinion or even Jewish American opinion. And in a sense, it's a lot like the National Rifle Association, which pushes for positions that aren't consistent with the views of the average American gun owner, let alone the average American overall. We would have no objection at all to there being a very powerful pro-Israel community community in the United States if that community were pushing for a more sensible set of policies and a more intelligent and open debate on U.S. Middle East policy more broadly. So it's not the existence of a diverse, large, and influential set of interest groups here. It's rather the fact that in recent years, in recent decades, that movement has been dominated by its hardline elements.
Well, I remember speaking with a former Knesset member, Marsha Friedman, who's founded an alternative to AIPAC called Brit Tzedek Tshalom.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically haven't gotten off the ground, as far as I can tell. So what's the problem here in the United States for liberal American Jews who are the dominant voice of Judaism, at least in terms of numbers? And they usually vote for the liberal Democratic slate. What's the problem? Why can't their voices get heard?
Well, their voices do get heard, but they just don't carry as much weight as organizations like AIPAC and the Conference of Presidents. But I want to make a slightly different point. Although there is a great deal of diversity inside the American Jewish community on the subject of Israel, it is important to emphasize that almost all of the groups believe that we should maintain the special relationship. And that means that almost all of the groups believe that we should continue to give Israel huge amounts of assistance and to give it unconditionally. And furthermore, they are almost all deeply opposed to the idea of the United States acting as an honest broker. And as long as the United States can not act as an honest broker, and as long as we have to give Israel unconditional aid, it is almost impossible for the United States to put any meaningful pressure on Israel to end the settlements, to end the occupation, and to create a viable Palestinian state. Now, to put this into a slightly broader context, people like Galia Golan are part of a diminishing number of peace-oriented activists in Israel. And Israel is actually becoming a much more hardline country over time. The settlers are growing in numbers and in influence. The religious parties are growing in numbers and influence. And if you look carefully at the poll data on how Israelis think about creating a viable Palestinian state, you see that there's just not much support for the basic outlines of the deal that would be necessary to create that state. So I think what you're going to see in the case of Israel is an increasingly hawkish country over time, a country that's increasingly unwilling to give the Palestinians a viable state of their own. And thus, when you marry that with the fact that the United States can't put any significant pressure on Israel because almost all of the groups in the lobby are opposed to that, you see that we're basically in a hopeless situation for the foreseeable future.
But isn't the real reason that the situation is getting worse is a direct result of incredibly counterintuitive U.S. foreign policy? The war in Iraq is a raging civil war that is effectively a surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia and others. It's likely to morph into a regional war any moment, and if we extend the war into Iran, it will surely become so. The dominoes will fall if not for the simple reason that there are so many Iraqi refugees in Jordan and Syria. Or the state of Jordan is a very tenuous state. It's likely to go under. If the Egyptians hadn't rigged the recent elections, the Muslim Brotherhood would have been elected. If they try and knock off the Assad family, you'll end up with the Muslim Brotherhood running Syria. It seems to me that what's happening here is that as a result of a catastrophic reverse domino effect, if you will, from this reckless utopian notion of the United States spreading democracy in the region, Israel is far more isolated today. And I would like to get from both of you gentlemen a picture of what will happen if Israel becomes a Ford Apache. What will the United States do? Will it essentially go back to what they claimed they were during the Cold War, which was the unsinkable aircraft carrier? Or will they be a tiny and beleaguered Ford Apache?
I think it's actually hard to know, but most of the trends you just mentioned are obviously deeply worrisome. They ought to be worrisome to Israelis and to the United States as well. And, you know, virtually everything I think the Bush administration has tried to do in the Middle East has come a cropper in various ways, from the initial decision to invade Iraq, the fact that they ignored the Israeli-Palestinian peace problem for years, this very ill-advised effort to promote the rapid democratization of the region. What you now see, of course, happening is groups in the lobby trying to portray this in very Huntingtonian terms as a sort of clash of civilizations where it's Israel and the United States against, you know, so-called Islamofascism, which is one of the, I think, sillier terms that's been coined, but trying to depict sort of the entire Arab and Islamic world as deeply hostile, and deeply hostile for no reason, just because they hate our religion, they hate our way of life. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the great dangers we face now is that we will essentially follow a set of policies similar to the ones we've been following that turn that into a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is ultimately not good for us and certainly not good for Israel. It is not good for Israel to be surrounded by a highly mobilized, very angry Arab population. I think if you look carefully, you'll see that, you know, Israel actually has had many opportunities to have peace with all of its neighbors. It has peace with Egypt and Jordan. It could have had a peace treaty with Syria. And the Saudis have been pushing a peace plan ever since 2002 that would essentially bring peace with the entire Arab world. This is very much what Israel needs to do now, not out of a sense of generosity, but out of a sense of its own self-interest, because over time, its prospects, if it doesn't get peace arrangements and finally put the Palestinian problem to rest, it, I think, doesn't have as bright a future as it could have otherwise.
Yeah, I think if you look at the policies that the lobby has been pushing, which is that the United States should invade Iraq, the United States should think about using military force against Iran, the United States should support Israel in the Lebanon war, and the United States should support Israel's behavior in the occupied territories. What you see from all of that is that the lobby has been pushing us to pursue policies that don't make any sense from America's point of view or from Israel's point of view. And that's one of the main reasons, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons that we're in so much trouble in the Middle East.
I thank both of you gentlemen for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheim, and for your book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. I'm speaking with General Wesley Clark, who is a retired four-star general of the United States Army, a former candidate for President of the United States, an author and activist. He spent 34 years in the Army and in the Department of Defense, receiving many military decorations, several honorary knighthoods, and a Presidential Medal of Freedom. Wesley Clark commanded Operation Allied Force in the Kosovo War during his term as the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, in other words, the SACEUR, the head of NATO, from 1997 to 2000. General Clark is also the author of several books, including Waging Modern Warfare, his latest, just out, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. And General Clark, of course, this book is an extraordinary addition to the lid being pried off a very secret regime. I've spoken in the past with Colonel Wilkerson, who was chief of staff to Colin Powell. He helped pry the lid off a little. In your book, you tell of an extraordinary meeting that you had shortly after 9/11 at the Pentagon. Could you fill us in a little on that?
Well, I had come into the Pentagon about maybe 2 weeks after 9/11, 10 days to 2 weeks, and I had gone in to see the Secretary of Defense because I was just a little uncomfortable. I was on television every day. I was talking about Al-Qaeda. I wasn't getting any intelligence. It was just my own knowledge from
And this was on CNN, right? That you were there?
It was on CNN, right. And I was on two or three times a day, it seemed like, at the beginning. And so I went in to see Rumsfeld. He said, well, I was doing okay. And then I had about 5 minutes with him, and then I left. And as I was leaving, one of the officers on the joint staff that had worked for me in the past called me, and he said, sir, you've got to come in here, and I've got to talk to you. And he told me when I went in that we were planning to invade Iraq. I asked him whether there was any connection with 9/11, and he said, no. He said, I don't know why they're planning to do it, but that's the plan. And he said, you know, it's like we're good at taking down states. We don't know what to do about terrorists. And if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to be a nail. That's the way he described it. And so I was disturbed I went back and watched and tried to get my sense of where the administration was going. I listened to the speeches. I remember going, seeing the president go down and visit the 101st at Fort Campbell saying, get ready, we're going to need you, we're going to need you. He was all hopping up the military. And it did sound like there was something more than simply going into Afghanistan. So I came back to the Pentagon in early to mid-November of 2001. By that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. Of course, the 101st wasn't committed to that. This was just a few special forces guys who were over there. And I went back in to see the same officer, and I said, well, I thought you had told me we were going to go into Iraq. We seem to be doing the right thing in Afghanistan. Are we still going into Iraq? He said, oh, sir, it's worse than that. He held up a piece of paper on his desk. He says, I just got this memo down from upstairs, pointed to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And it outlines a campaign strategy to go after 7 states in 5 years.
Now, this is 2001. So.
Right. Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and then Iran.
Wow.
And I was just staggered. He was bringing the paper over to show it to me. I said, is it classified? He said, yes. I said, don't show it to me. I hadn't gotten any classified information. I was on CNN. I didn't want to be in a recipient of classified information. I didn't want to look at those documents. I was so stunned by this, and it was so unbelievable that it took me a long time to focus on it. And it was only after I saw the administration's determination and to go to war with Iraq. I listened to what Karl Rove said. I got reports from the British. I heard from American officers. All the public palaver was wrong. It was all a smokescreen. I went over and I talked to Senator Graham, who was a friend of mine. I talked to Senator Kerry. I warned Kerry what was going to happen and when the timing was and so forth. It was clear as the nose on your face what was going to happen, and that this was the first step in much more to follow. And I realized later, much later, the memory came back of the conversation I'd had with Paul Wolfowitz in 1991. Paul Wolfowitz in 1991 was the number 3 guy in the Defense Department. Then he moved up to number 2 when the Bush administration came in 2001. And in 1991, he had told me that the key lesson of the Gulf War was that we had to had 5 or 10 years to use military force to knock out these old client regimes of the Soviet Union in the Persian Gulf, countries like Iraq and Syria, before the next great superpower came along and contested the region. And I was stunned when he said it, because it was such an obvious strategic play, and yet people don't think that way. America's not an aggressive nation. We don't play 19th century geopolitics. We don't invade and knock off regimes and seize countries and consider the world like a chessboard. That's not who we are as a people. And so what he was suggesting was, you know, it was so wide of the mark of everything I knew about the American character that it was a passing conversation that struck a chord, and I remembered it. And here we were, 1991 to 2001. It was as though a coup had taken place, and a group of people had seized control of the government and imposed this strategy of Wolfowitz's from 10 years earlier, despite all the president's pretensions of running as a compassionate conservative with a humble foreign policy and not doing peacekeeping and nation building. Suddenly we were embarked on a campaign of aggression.
But this reckless utopianism that drove this counterproductive and counterintuitive foreign policy, we are manifestly reaping the whirlwind. There's no doubt that all of this has backfired in the most hideous way. You only have to look what happened last week, General Wesley Clark, where General Sanchez, the first commander in Iraq after the invasion and the first commander of the occupation, said, finally went public, said there's been a glaring and unfortunate display of incompetent strategic leadership within our national leaders. He recused them of derelict in their duties and guilty of a lust for power, and furthermore went on to say that if the people on the National Security Council had to live by military standards, they would have all been court-martialed.
Well, Sanchez was absolutely justified in what he was saying. There was a lapse of leadership. There was a failure. But it wasn't just the National Security Council staff. It was the President of the United States, the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense. It was not even utopianism. It was a flight of fantasy. There's just no other way to describe it, a flight of fantasy, that we could take a Christian Jewish army into the Persian Gulf, start knocking off states and imposing democratic processes on cultures that had never experienced that kind of government. It was a flight of fantasy. And every academician, and most of us who had been educated, gone through Vietnam, understood the processes of and what happens when you're in a foreign country, we all objected to it. We warned against it. We knew what it was.
Well, there's a lot of people, including people from President Bush's father's administration, who tried to warn, starting with Brent Scowcroft, President Bush's closest friend and advisor, General Zinni, former CENTCOM commander, Schwarzkopf. I spoke to a bunch of people myself.
I thought Zinni was a little slow in warning, honestly, but Joe Hoare, who was
the Marine commander,
he was very clear. I testified with Charlie Kashvili and Joe Hoare and an Air Force general at the Senate Armed Services Committee in the fall of 2002. And it was very clear to Joe Hoare exactly what was going to happen, and he was very courageous in speaking out.
But I think it was clear to people who knew the region, who spoke Arabic, who knew that the strategic notion of containing Iran, I mean, after all, that was what that eight-year war was about, the Iran-Iraq war.
Saddam Hussein was the cork in the bottle. He was the plug at the end of the Persian Gulf that checked the militant Shia expansionism. And that is what the war was about. And by knocking him off, we had effectively taken the brakes off Iran.
And General Clark, here we are today with a civil war that's morphed into a surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Egypt, and I guess now the United States switched sides and joined the Sunnis. How does this now proxy war not become a regional war?
Well, I think it's a matter of how far the respective sides want to push it. Inside Iraq right now, and this is in more detail really than I was able to get into in my book, which is more about America's role and American leadership, but just to go inside Iraq for a moment, there are many different Shia factions. They're not unified yet. They've got to sort out who's in charge, where, and how one relates to another. The two principal factions are both, of course, engaged with Iran. Muqtada al-Sadr's faction is less inclined toward an Iranian client-state relationship than Hakim's faction. But both factions are using they're in debt to Iran. Iran has a major effort in this area. But it's not clear that the Iranian Shia, whoever emerges on top or whatever coalition of groups, want to be subsumed as a province of Iran. So there'll always be some desire to hang on to the United States and use us as an excuse as to why they can't buckle completely under the will of Iran. At least that's the way I would predict it, unless we force it and through our actions toward Iran, force the Iraqi Shia to choose sides. If we do that, we will go into a sort of East-West Cold War type or hot war divide through the center or through the various regions in Iraq, with a buffer zone of Sunnis formed up in Anbar province and the Shia doing Iran's will, and it will be a regional war.
And if indeed the surge is in fact a de facto or belated de facto recognition that both the Sunni on the United States part that in effect they're fighting the wrong people, isn't it inevitable that it seems that we're already in a countdown with what General Petraeus is saying about Iranian interference and bringing in ordnance and training people? It seems to me that we're on that path, and that's the worst scenario. A less dire scenario would be that already we are suffering the dominoes, if you will, are falling against us rather than for us, as the neocons promised. Look at the frail state of Jordan. It's being swamped by refugees. You'll have if indeed the Sunni are defeated, which seems to be numerically the what one could predict. you'll have a lot of angry, trained, armed people in the state of Jordan. Where do you think they're going to turn?
Exactly. No, there are some very dire scenarios that can spin out of this. I think that as of right now, the United States government, at least, is refusing to publicly acknowledge its failure. And what I'm asking is, what is the strategy? This is what Congress ought to be asking. This is what democratic activists ought to be asking. What is this American strategy that's made us weaker and our enemy stronger at the cost of $800 billion and 4,000 American lives, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've been killed and maimed in this operation? What is this strategy? This administration has no answer for that. And that is the key question that should be used to hold the Republican Party and all of its henchmen out there responsible during the 2008 presidential campaign. I hope we won't be continuing to dwell on the exact numbers of troops in Iraq or whether the surge is working or not militarily. Those are really military matters. And the administration is guilty of geostrategic failure. It's not the military. It's the administration. And I think we have to keep this clearly in mind.
But General Clark, it seems that that if you've got this situation where, in effect, the only people who are paying the price for this war are the military and the military families. This is not an American war. It's being done on the cheap through contractors. It's all funded off the books. There's no involvement. I've just been watching the World War II series on PBS, where you really saw that the whole nation pulled together in the
This is a Rush Limbaugh war. This is a war that you can feel good about on right-wing talk radio. You can beat your chest on, but you don't have to necessarily get involved in it yourself. And yet, there are so many middle-class and working Americans whose sons and daughters have gone off to this war, either in the active forces or the National Guard and Reserve, and this administration has done so little to give them the assistance and support they need.
General Wesley Clark is talking to us in his new book, A Time to Lead. Why do you think you mentioned the Democratic Party, and you obviously ran on the Democratic ticket back in 2004? Why haven't they really made an issue out of the troops? I know Senator Webb, the freshman, tried to make that the central issue.
Democratic Party doesn't control the Congress in sufficient strength to be able to make an issue out of the troops. But I would argue that it would be a mistake to make an issue out of the troops. I'm fine with the Webb Amendment. But look, the Congress doesn't need to tell the president to withdraw troops. The president wants to withdraw troops. He knows this war is an albatross around his neck. So when he withdraws troops, do you think he's going to thank the Democratic Congress and say, thank you very much for encouraging me to draw troops. It turned out to be exactly the right thing. No, he's not going to say that. He's going to say, my policy is succeeding and I'm able to withdraw troops. And, you know, to those Democrats who didn't have the courage and stamina to respect our men and women in the armed forces, this shows you that, you know, we were right, you were wrong, we were succeeding. You just didn't have patience and faith in the American fighting man. Oh, it'll be ugly. And that's what's coming over the summer. So I would encourage Democrats to move off the troop issue and move on to the strategy issue. That's the administration's failure.
So, General Clark, do you think that that if the Turks pull the plug on supply and make it almost impossible to maintain the war, will that give President Bush the political cover? Is he looking for political cover to get out?
I think what's going to give President Bush the political cover to get out is that I do think the ethnic cleansing is moving toward its conclusion. I wouldn't say it's completed, but in many of the areas around Baghdad, to the south of Baghdad, the ethnic cleansing has been completed. What's left are the internecine power struggles between the various factional militias and their political arms, and that remains to be worked out, but that won't result in the kind of massive killings that you've seen. That results in the casual assassinations, the bomb that kills the governor and so forth, but not in the market bombing and the terror that's gone on. I think it's reasonable to expect that casualties will decline, absent some U.S. move against Iran in the near term. And so, therefore, I think it's also reasonable to predict that because of the decline in casualties, the president will, for political reasons in the United States, by next summer, be crowing about pulling troops back. And remember, to gain the political benefits of this, no American here in the United States really knows how many troops are in Iraq. I mean, there's no way for us to know. What we listen to is the announcements. All he has to do is announce the pullback and say, oh, we're going to have less than 100,000 there by Christmas time of 2008, and he will have substantially won the argument on troop drawdown. And then at that point, what are the Democrats going to say? No, 100,000 is not low enough. It has to be 80,000. Mm-hmm. And then you're back arguing about military affairs when the critical argument is not military, it's strategic.
Well, it's also accountability, surely. I mean, here we have a situation where you have a choice either to believe that our president is either a cynic or a coward. Either he's been told, which we believe he's been told on numerous occasions, how dire the situation is. Well, I believe that both Abizaid and Casey told him on any number of occasions, and yet he has hung in there at the expense of our military and our treasury. And the theory has been that he's not man enough to admit that he's made a mistake and pull the plug, and is therefore going to keep this agony going long enough so that the next person, in or man or woman, inherits it.
I think there's no doubt about that.
So that's a pretty dismal choice between cowardice and cynicism.
On the other hand, it's also true that the U.S. forces there aren't really gripping the enemy. What we are is we're a veneer under which all of this political strife and struggle with its military aspect is occurring, in which the Iraqis themselves are sorting out, underneath the purple-fingered voters, they're sorting out who's really in charge. Maliki's a show. Underneath, there are forces that have real power in regions in Iraq. Maliki isn't one of those. He's a government of show. But that's being sorted out. And there's no reason to expect that the situation a year from now is going to look like it does right now. There's every reason to believe that the situation a year from now will have a greater degree of stability. It just won't be in our interest, necessarily. And it'll be more along the lines that you suggested earlier, that there'll be a hardening of the divisions, and our enemies will have gained ground. And the United States may well at that point have switched sides. But all of this was predictable. All of this is the evidence of his strategic failure. And so what I would ask the activist community to do, if you're concerned about the United States and our future in the world, to speak out against the strategic failure of Iraq. Not against the troop levels, against the strategic failure.
And how we'll be paying for this for decades to come. It's not
exactly.
Our entire arrangements in that part of the world may well go out the window. I mean, you know, we were talking earlier about how we, in effect, hanging it by a thread. If there's a regional war, then the immediate consequence would be, particularly if it's between Saudi and Iran, which is really where the lines are drawn. You'd have the Western economic lifeline cut. That would then reward the Soviet, I mean, not the Soviets, I slip of the tongue there, Russia and Venezuela.
And China. It's not just, you have to think in, let's not think only in military terms, let's think in economic terms. There are many states in the region that are selling oil at these high prices, and the longer that we continue to fight there, the higher the price of oil will grow. And the more risk there is of a confrontation with Iran, the greater the risk premium that's embedded in the price of oil. So $100 a barrel, $110 a barrel, $120 a barrel, and yet that's delivering huge wealth into the region and huge power to a state like Russia. And so the results are worldwide. It's not just the military consequences in the Persian Gulf. It's the flight from the dollar, the exchange rate. It's American jobs. It's American influence, its ability to work diplomacy, to gain treaty agreements, to prevent aggression, to resolve problems like Darfur, to be able to bring allies to bear and work problems like the problem of Iran's nuclear potential. All of this is at risk as we continue our mistaken strategy in the region.
Again, General Wesley Clark, the author of A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country, and now here he is telling the activist community of the United States to get up and wake up and start focusing on what's really going on in terms of the political divide, and that the Democratic Party may well be falling for the wrong argument, arguing about truth levels, when in fact the president may well do an end run around them, do a cosmetic troop reduction, but at the same time, nobody out there is calling for the accountability, except, as I mentioned, General Sanchez. He wasn't mincing words, General Clark.
Well, I think those of us who've been there and seen it on the ground or know war at heart, we know what accountability is all about, and we recognize the failure. I think it's hard for people back in the States who haven't made this their life's work to see the enormity of the strategic blunder that we're in.
And just in closing, General Clark, General Hayden from the NSA took over the job as the head of the CIA, he talked about a paucity of strategic thinking in this country. How do you do a kind of rapid injection of strategic thinking and get it into the government? Or is it a case that our political leaders are simply, you know, if you got somebody like George W. Bush, he just doesn't want to be bothered by the facts? I mean, are we deficient in strategic thinking, or is the problem?
Of course. I mean, strategic thinking has to be done once in a generation. People spend their entire lives studying the problem of strategic thought. And it's impossible for most busy congressional leaders to absorb the facets, the mind frame, the perspective, the history, the background, and construct some new strategic syllogism. It doesn't happen. We were happy for 40 years in this country with containment and deterrence. We wanted to contain the expansion of Soviet communism. We wanted to deter the Soviets' attack on Western Europe or elsewhere around the periphery. By and large, we succeeded. It was a bipartisan policy. Democrats and Republicans always disagreed on the margins, but the core of it was bipartisan. There's no bipartisan consensus on where we're going. On the left, there's no real strategic doctrine that's emerged at all. On the right is the neocon doctrine, which says, use military force regime change in the Middle East, try to create an environment of client states friendly and beholden to the United States. That's clearly failed. It was wrong. It was an un-American strategy to start with. We don't do things like that. And it's why it failed, and it must fail. But what we need is to first recognize and talk about the failure. The alternative strategy will emerge, as it must, and it will be obvious, as it must, if we fully understand the magnitude of the strategic failure of the neocon vision. And that's what George Bush basically has followed.
General Clark, I must say, it sounds like the 12-step program with Alcoholics Anonymous. First, you've got to acknowledge you've got a problem.
Well, I think it's rigid thinking that's led to so many of the problems that we have right now. But I do believe that in the case of public dialogue, you can't affect a change in something of the magnitude of U.S. national strategy unless people appreciate that the current strategy has failed.
Well, I thank you so much for filling us in with your wisdom here today, General Wesley Clark. I know the audience appreciates it. Again, I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, General Wesley Clark.
Thank you. Real pleasure to be with you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and that was General Wesley Clark. His book is A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. I thank Louis Venenberg, the producer, and Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org.